The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News.
And good evening. Wall Street today signaled its approval of the tax cuts passed by the Republican-controlled Congress.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The suspected gunman who shot dead five journalists had a long history of threats against their newspaper.
I feared for my life, I feared for my family's life, and I feared for my staff's life.
Plus, what's next for the Supreme Court?
We will begin our search for a new justice.
Later, what's at stake for a summit between President Trump and Vladimir Putin?
For both presidents, it's important to come out of this summit showing that it's been a success.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Let's start this weekend in Annapolis, Maryland, just about an hour outside Washington. It's where police say 38-year-old Jared Ramos shot and killed five journalists at the Capital Gazette newspaper Thursday.
He was as angry an individual as I have ever seen.
Attorney Brennan McCarthy says Jared Ramos tormented his client for years.
She lost her job because of him.
She lost her job because of this individual. He is malevolent. He forwarded a letter to her employer basically stating that she was bipolar and a drunkard, which is ridiculous.
McCarthy says the harassment and stalking began around 2009 after they became friends on Facebook. In 2011, she took him to court where he pleaded guilty to criminal harassment and was placed on 18 months probation. 5 days later, the Capital Gazette wrote a story titled Jared Wants to Be Your Friend. It outlined Ramos' alleged erratic behavior, including emails he allegedly sent telling McCarthy's client, go hang yourself. You're going to need a restraining order now, and you can't make me stop.
Mr. Ramos was obsessively angry about this particular story.
Ramos sued the paper for defamation in 2012. The case was dismissed in 2015 on appeal. According to court documents, the judge said there is nothing to prove anything that was published was in fact false.
I, for one, received what I consider to be a death threat.
Tom Marquard was the Capitol's executive editor at the time of the article. He said he went to police about Ramos' threat, but was told nothing could be done.
I feared for my life, I feared for my family's life, and I feared for my staff's life.
A Twitter page believed to belong to Ramos has hundreds of angry tweets going back to 2011 about his case, the paper, and even McCarthy. Ramos' most recent tweet just hours before the shooting was directed at the judge who dismissed his defamation case.
He wanted to get revenge.
McCarthy said on Thursday when he heard about the shooting at the Capitol newspaper, he immediately thought of Ramos.
I knew who did it. He did it.
And you've said it was inevitable.
It was inevitable.
That he would eventually
do something.
He was going
to do something violent. The only question was, who would he get first?
Chip Reed reporting. Jane Schlegel is news director at our CBS News radio affiliate in Annapolis, WNAV. Jane, describe the location of where the newsroom's located.
This is right adjacent to Westfield Annapolis Mall. Off of West Street in Annapolis, it's a very heavily traveled road, typically, and the location of the building is semi-like office complex. There are other offices inside the building besides it housing one of the oldest newspapers, if not the oldest newspaper.
Tell me about this newspaper. Do you see them out at city council meetings, at state
Oh, the Capital newspaper is very local. It's a hometown newspaper. It's one of the oldest newspapers. It's actually owned by the Baltimore Sun, but they've had local reporters. They have local sports. They have local everything local for the audience in this Annapolis City, capital of Maryland area, and of course regional, and then they feature headline news also.
WNAV Radio News Director Jane Schlegel on the Weekend Roundup. Now to the week's other big stories at the Supreme Court. Let's begin with Justice Anthony Kennedy's decision to retire.
We will begin our search for a new justice of the United States Supreme Court that will begin immediately.
A key swing vote. The 81-year-old's retirement gives the president the chance to turn the court more solidly to the right for a generation. Democrats warned of a fight.
People, from all across America should realize that their rights and opportunities are threatened.
But firmly in control of the Senate, Republicans said a new justice would be on the court by October.
We will vote to confirm Justice Kennedy's successor this fall.
The bitter divide was in stark contrast to the gentlemanly justice who sometimes crossed ideological lines.
I am today announcing my intention to nominate United States Circuit Judge Anthony Kennedy.
Nominated by President Ronald Reagan,
I, Anthony Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
Kennedy was confirmed unanimously. He sometimes sided with liberals on key social issues, earning him a reputation as a swing vote.
I hate that term. It has this visual image of these spatial gyrations. The cases swing. I don't.
His defining legacy will be gay rights. He wrote all the major decisions striking down laws banning homosexuality and legalizing same-sex marriage nationwide, writing that same-sex couples were seeking equal dignity in the eyes of the law. But far more often, Kennedy was with conservatives. He wrote a sharp dissent in the decision upholding Obamacare. And while he refused to overturn Roe v. Wade, he allowed restrictions on abortion rights.
And already in Washington, this is gearing up to be a fight over abortion. There is one justice on the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas, who said he would overturn Roe v. Wade. We don't know how the other three conservatives would rule, but two liberal justices are now going to be in their 80s this year. So the specter of a retirement and a shift in the court is something that's going to affect elections for years to come. Jan Crawford, CBS News, the Supreme Court.
Conservatives and the White House also celebrating another Supreme Court victory, a ruling upholding the president's latest travel ban targeting several mostly Muslim countries.
By a vote of 5-4, on Tuesday, the Supreme Court upheld President Trump's travel ban in place since December. It applies to people from five countries with overwhelmingly Muslim populations: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. It also affects North Korea and some Venezuelan residents. Judges on the East and West Coasts have argued the policy was a form of religious discrimination. But the nation's highest court said the travel order is squarely within the scope of presidential authority.
Muslims are welcome here!
Demonstrators gathered across the country to protest the decision, and politicians on both sides of the aisle spoke out.
Immigration law explicitly gives the president the authority to make determinations in the national interest to keep us safe.
The Supreme Court has endorsed bigotry and Islamophobia.
President Trump has said the policy is in place to keep Islamic extremists out.
Tremendous victory for the American people and for our Constitution. This is a great victory for our Constitution.
Laura Podesta, CBS News, New York.
The Supreme Court also dealt a blow to public sector unions, ruling non-union workers don't have to pay collective bargaining fees to them. Still to come, let's make a deal?
President Trump promised, even when he was a candidate and since then, that he could make a deal with Russia.
That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Well, the White House has announced that the president plans to meet Russia's Vladimir Putin July 16th in Helsinki, Finland. Here's correspondent Stephen Portnoy at the White House.
They've held talks twice before on the sidelines of international meetings last year, but this will be the first formal summit between the two in a city that has hosted past U.S. and Russian or Soviet meetings. The timing is interesting. Mr. Trump will sit with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki just days after he meets with the NATO allies in Brussels. Of course, NATO was formed as a check on Soviet aggression. President Trump says Russia's involvement in Ukraine and Syria are issues he'll raise with Putin.
Angela Stent is a professor at Georgetown and director of the university's Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies. Angela, what's at stake for this meeting in Helsinki?
Well, there's really quite a lot at stake. The U.S.-Russian relationship is now worse than it's been since any time since before Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in 1985. We obviously still have a significant Russia investigation going on domestically, but if you put that aside, we've had rounds of sanctions imposed on the Russians. We, you know, have accused the Russians of interfering in our elections. But we really, it's quite dangerous because we haven't had kind of regularized high-level contacts for a number of years now, really beginning with when the Russians annexed Crimea in 2014. And so the Russians certainly would like to put this relationship on a better basis. But of course, President Trump promised, even when he was a candidate and since then, that he could make a deal with Russia, that he didn't understand why we had such bad relations with Russia. So I think for both presidents, it's important to come out of this summit showing that it's been a success.
What's the potential then for the president to get something out of this?
Well, I think it'll be enough for him, I would think, if he comes out of it, as he really did from the summit with Kim Jong-un, saying, we've met, we had a good talk, we've agreed to cooperate. It could be on arms control, it could be on Syria, Ukraine, counterterrorism, could be a number of things. If he comes out and says, we agreed to do these things and we're going to set up these channels of communication now, I would say it looks good for him anyway. What we won't know is the result of this, because obviously it takes a long time to see whether these things are actually implemented.
What about the view from Europe? What is Europe worried about as this summit is being planned?
President Trump will be coming from a NATO summit just days before he meets President Putin. And the NATO allies are very worried that he may, for instance, tell the Russians, as he already said after the G7 meeting, oh, Crimea is part of Russia. You know, we recognize it's part of Russia. Well, that's not what the NATO allies agree on, or that he might make some concessions to the Russians that have to do with the war, the ongoing war in southeastern Ukraine. So they're concerned about a deal being done over their heads. And I think they're concerned about the summit itself because he's been very critical of NATO, President Trump, saying that the allies don't spend enough on defense.
Georgetown University's Angela Stent on this upcoming Trump-Putin summit in Helsinki. Thanks, Angela.
Okay, thank you.
Now to the race for Congress. 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who describes herself as a Democratic Socialist, pulled off a stunning political victory in New York Tuesday night. She ousted one of the top-ranking Democrats in Congress in the primary, Joe Crowley. Ms. Ocasio-Cortez, I want to play you House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's reaction to your victory when a reporter asked her if it's a sign that Democratic Party leadership needs to shift more to the left or be more inclusive.
The fact that in a very progressive district in New York, it went more progressive than Joe Crowley is a progressive, but more to the left than Joe Crowley is about that district. It is not to be viewed as something that stands for everything else.
What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I certainly think that we were giving a voice to our community, absolutely. You know, I also think that there is room for a little bit stronger advocacy for the issues of working class Americans, for a little bit more clarity in our agenda and our legislation that we want to champion for working class Americans. And, you know, I do think that working class people in the United States are willing to hear a little bit more of that message.
But Nancy Pelosi would argue that this is the working class party. This is the party of unions. This is the party of low-income families. What then needs to change?
Well, you know, we're certainly more the party of that than I would argue the Republican Party is. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we can rest on our laurels. You know, I think that we learned a lot of things recently. You know, union turnout has lowered, and especially right now in a time when unions are under attack. And, you know, I think that if we kind of rediscover and revitalize the constituencies that have made the Democratic Party who we are, there's so much possibility for us as a party.
Let me ask you this. If you're elected in November, will you support Nancy Pelosi as minority leader?
You know, I just think it's way too... I just found out that I'm going to be in Congress, so I don't think that I can answer any sort of question about that. I'm just working to make sure that we win the House in November. That is all I kind of want to talk about on there on that front.
So you haven't thought about that?
No. I think that this is a question that's happening over and over again, and honestly, it doesn't mean that we just automatically go to who's two or three in line. We have to talk about, we ask about this whole question of Pelosi, but no one else's name is discussed. And so I don't think that we can have this conversation without knowing the name.
But do you think people, at least some of them, voted for you as a rebuke of the current Democratic leadership?
I think it's a rebuke, or, you know, I think what it is it's a resonance and a desire for a new direction that could mean, I mean, it could or could not mean new people. You know, we don't know. It could mean a new message. And we're going to find out as these primaries continue and as we find out exactly what delegation we're sending to Congress.
Do you feel like in your campaign you got the support of the Democratic Party and the establishment that you deserved?
Deserve is an interesting word. Did I get the support? No. Did I get even recognition? No. But I also never felt entitled to it because I knew exactly what I was walking into. I knew that my opponent was the chairman and was in charge of that. So I never felt entitled to have that myself. And I just knew that the only way that you face a machine is with a movement, and that we had to build that movement. And that is what we were able to accomplish.
And you harbor no resentment towards that?
No, I don't think I harbor resentment. I knew what it was the entire time that I was up against, and I didn't even really try too hard to try to curry that favor because I knew that I wasn't going to get it. So I just kind of built my own house.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Up next, a new at-home method for women to test their fertility on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Sunday nights, Monday mornings, or Tuesday afternoons. You can listen to 60 Minutes whenever you want with the weekly podcast from CBS News.
How do we know you're telling the truth?
Because I have no reason to lie.
With hard-hitting investigative reports, interviews, and profiles.
Did these documents that you got prove corruption?
Oh, absolutely.
From a variety of CBS News correspondents and contributors.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
For the biggest scoops and the best storytelling, subscribe to the 60 Minutes podcast today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. We're learning more about a mysterious deadly shooting at a popular California state park. Tristan Baudette was killed in his tent while camping with his two young daughters at Malibu State Park last Friday. But now, CBS News has learned at least five other shootings happened in the park area within the last 2 years. Here's correspondent Carter Evans.
So where were you set up here?
So I was just down right here.
James Rogers was sound asleep at his campsite in November 2016 when a stinging pain jolted him awake at 3 a.m.
I tried to get up and just fell right through the hammock down to the ground.
So you had no idea what happened?
No idea.
It wasn't until pellets started falling out of his right arm that Rogers knew he'd been shot.
These are shotgun pellets.
Yeah, it's bird shot, so they're a little bit smaller. I think they're like 3-millimeter diameter BBs, but it shoots 100 of them.
Roger's campsite was within about a mile of where Tristan Baudette was shot and killed early Friday morning. Baudette was inside his tent and camping with his 2 and 4-year-old daughters. Investigators confirmed there have been 3 other shootings in the area, 2 from 2017 and 1 that happened just 4 days before Baudette was killed. James Rogers described his case to California State Parks, but says they never followed up with an official report.
Obviously, this latest incident is just such a tragedy.
I mean, if there had been a warning,
he probably wouldn't have booked the campsite for his family.
California State Parks officials declined to provide any information about any of the shootings, and sheriff's investigators won't say if they're any closer to finding the gunman. Meanwhile, the entire campground where Baudette was shot is closed indefinitely. Carter Evans, CBS News, Calabasas, California.
Authorities are investigating a deadly explosion at a building under construction near Coryell Memorial Healthcare System in Gatesville, Texas. Hospital CEO David Byram.
Now there were 12 injured with one fatality, and they were all
construction workers at that point in time. We've had no injuries to a staff or resident.
The hospital complex was undergoing a major expansion. After years of an experimental treatment for one type of brain cancer, doctors now say it may offer new hope to patients. CBS News Chief Medical Correspondent Dr. John LaPook explains.
Put your nose in my finger.
61-year-old Debbie Puffer has been a patient at Duke University since 2014. When doctors began treating her deadly brain cancer, glioblastoma, with a most unlikely weapon, poliovirus. At first, she was skeptical.
I was just going to go home and bury my head in the sand. And then I realized, no, I'm not supposed to do that.
The poliovirus, genetically modified so it can't cause polio, is injected directly into the tumor, attaching to a protein on the cell's surface. It begins its attack on the tumor, then jumpstarts the immune system to finish the job. Dr. Daryl Bigner is part of the team at Duke. So it's kind of a 1-2 punch?
Exactly. But the most important part, we believe, actually is the secondary immune response.
1 month after treatment,
it started to break the tumor up.
Husband Mark Puffer.
They called Debbie
a rapid
responder.
Puffer's improvement was not a fluke. 21% of 61 patients were still alive 3 years after treatment, compared to just 4% typically seen with standard care.
Could you ever have imagined having a response rate that high?
It's just mind-blowing to us that have been working on it for so long, because this is based on absolutely bedrock scientific principles.
Last year, Puffer was retreated when her tumor showed signs of returning.
Maybe this time we killed the dragon. I'm not sure.
Despite some memory and vision problems, she can now see a future.
I meant to be here for a reason. I don't know what that reason is, but I'm sure going to hang around to find out.
Dr. John LaPook, CBS News, New York.
More women are turning to technology to help test their fertility as they put off having children. Correspondent Maria Villarreal has more.
Lauren Denham is a lifestyle blogger and actress.
You know what? If you won't do it, I will.
She's also a stand-in for stars like Reese Witherspoon on TV and movie sets. Denham says she was so focused on her career that having children didn't cross her mind until she turned 30 last year.
I was like, well, I'm not ready, but my body is, and it probably is time to start thinking about it. And that's when I started thinking about, oh, well, maybe I should freeze my eggs, look at my options.
Because eggs decrease in both quantity and quality with age, an increasing number of women are choosing to freeze their eggs during their prime reproductive years. Denham wanted to know whether she should move forward now or wait, which is what led her to Modern Fertility. The company referred us to Denham to hear her story.
This was just something I could literally order online right now, get the test it on my own time, and get the results in a couple days.
After a woman orders the test online, she pricks her finger, places drops of blood on a test strip, and sends it back to an accredited lab where it's tested for 9 hormones. The company then sends back a physician-reviewed online profile. It explains how her hormone levels may affect the number of eggs she has left, if she's ovulating normally, and potential red flags that could affect her fertile window.
What about these cards?
Carly Leahy and Afton Vakri co-founded Modern Fertility last year. They wanted to make testing done at fertility clinics easily available to women everywhere.
We're really speaking to women much earlier in life who know that a career may be important and they may want to have children down the road, but want to be able to check in proactively.
Industry experts say getting this testing done and consulting with a doctor through a clinic costs an average of $600 compared to the $199 test offered by Modern Fertility.
Because we're opening this up to now half the population, we can achieve economies of scale and offer a much lower price point.
Dr. Aldo Palmieri is the director of OBGYN at UCLA Medical Center, Santa Monica. He says it's important to remember that hormone levels alone cannot predict whether a woman will be able to conceive naturally, and worries women may misinterpret their test results.
Patients will be led to conclusions that may be incorrect, because if the test results show all the levels are normal, it doesn't mean that they're fertile necessarily.
There are critics that will say, you are not doctors. This could give people a false sense of hope. How do you respond to them? There are many things required for a successful pregnancy, and at Modern Fertility, we're focused on fertility education.
Both Dr. Palmieri and the company recommend consulting with a doctor about the test results.
So mine, I'm at the very bottom.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that was what was really concerning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Denham's profile showed low levels of a key hormone that affects the number of eggs she's producing. That prompted her to meet with her gynecologist, who recommended retesting her hormones in a few months. She's chosen to increase certain vitamins and supplements and is researching freezing her eggs within the next 3 months.
I still don't know if I want kids, but I know that I want the choice. So this is me being proactive to hopefully have that choice.
Maria Villarreal reporting. Coming up next on the Weekend Roundup, Republicans put pressure on the Deputy Attorney General to wrap up the special counsel's Russia probe.
Finish it the hell up.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. There were fireworks at a hearing on Capitol Hill Tuesday. Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee outraged at Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Christopher Wray calling on the Justice Department to wrap up the special counsel's Russia probe. South Carolina Congressman Trey Gowdy.
There's an old saying that justice delayed is justice denied. I think right now all of us are being denied. Whatever you got, finish it the hell up.
Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan also accusing Rosenstein of stonewalling Congress's oversight investigation into that Russia probe. Vice President Mike Pence wrapped up a tour of Latin America Friday after telling leaders in Central America they need to do more to stop their citizens from illegally entering the U.S. Correspondent Ed O'Keefe has more from Guatemala City.
This exodus must end. It is a threat to the security of the United States. And just as we respect your borders and your sovereignty, we insist that you respect ours.
Vice President Pence delivering tough talk late Thursday to the presidents of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. After meeting privately with the three leaders, Pence said,
"Tell your people that coming to the United States illegally will only result in a hard journey and a harder life."
That warning of a harder life is a reality Liliana Medina now knows all too well.
Realmente yo no quise que él viajara, porque la verdad, separarse de la familia.
She didn't try fleeing to the United States, but her husband and 15-year-old son did. Earlier this month, somewhere in Mexico, as they traveled towards the U.S., her husband died. Now she waits for her son to be sent back from Mexico to this halfway house for migrants. People who crossed the border told us that it would be easier to get into the U.S. with a child, she said. Now she wishes her husband and son had never left.
Here at Casa del Migrante, they'll house at least 2,500 people this year. In this room right now, there's a young family with a 5-year-old boy fleeing violence. They're trying to sort out what they'll do next.
Father Mauro Verzaletti runs the shelter. If he could speak with American officials, Verzaletti said he would tell them, invest less money on border control and building a wall and use it instead on economic development. And Medina says Guatemala's government should be doing more to help the nation's poor indigenous people like her. The president should provide jobs and help poor people so they don't need to flee, she said. Medina doesn't know when her son will return, but she vows to wait until he arrives. Ed O'Keefe, CBS News, Guatemala City.
A federal judge in California has ordered the Trump administration to reunite separated immigrant families within 30 days. The order, following an ACLU lawsuit, also sets a 14-day deadline for children under 5 to be returned to their parents. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says more than 2,000 kids remain separated from their parents. Correspondent David Begno has the latest from Mission, Texas, along the U.S.-Mexico border.
It's a preliminary injunction issued in the Southern District of California by U.S. District Judge Dana Sabra, which says the government is blocked from carrying out any future family separations. The order also says parents cannot be deported before being reunited with their children. Under the present system, Judge Sabra writes, migrant children are not being accounted for with the same efficiency and accuracy as property. Certainly, that cannot satisfy the requirements of due process.
We do not want any children separated from their parents any longer than absolutely necessary under the law.
Hours before the judge's order, President Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, told Congress that the government would not return children to parents who were being held in custody.
Of course, if the parent remains in detention, unfortunately, under rules that are set by Congress and the courts, they can't be reunified.
Azar is referring to the Flores Agreement. That says that immigrant children cannot be held in detention for more than 20 days. David Begno, CBS News, along the Mexico border in Mission, Texas.
When all is said and done this weekend before Independence Day, the TSA expects the number of passengers it screens to possibly set a record. TSA Administrator David Pekoski.
We think that we may have over 2.6 million passengers go through our screen checkpoints around the country.
A hijacking scare aboard a JetBlue plane at JFK Tuesday evening. Here's correspondent Chris Van Cleve.
Dozens of emergency vehicles surrounded JetBlue Flight 1623 after air traffic control lost all contact with the pilots.
JetBlue, that's on Bravo. If you can hear us.
We saw all these flashing lights, and like everyone on the flight just noticed at once.
Alexa Curtis was on board as heavily armed police entered the cabin and ordered passengers to put their hands in the air.
I thought I was going to die. Like, and how they were pointing the guns, they were pointing them like at us. People were like crying. Everyone's texting their families, and we were on the ground. So usually this would like happen in the air if it was going to happen.
JetBlue says the Airbus A321 experienced a radio issue impacting the crew's ability to communicate, and a false alarm was sent to JFK Tower. While communication was reestablished via alternative channels, authorities responded out of an abundance of caution. In an emergency, the plane's transponder can be used to signal the tower. FAA officials say the false alarm was triggered by the pilots mistakenly entering the four-digit squawk code for hijack, 7500 instead of 7600, which signals radio failure. Former airline captain Ross Amer.
As a pilot, I would have explained to him exactly what happened. And if it was my mistake, I apologize. I say, folks, I screwed up. We're only human. We all make mistakes.
Police found no security issue on board and gave the all clear. The plane returned to the gate for a while as a new crew was assigned, and it did eventually get to Los Angeles after about a four-hour delay. The FAA is investigating. Chris Van Cleve, CBS News, Washington.
The patriarch of the Jackson 5, Joe Jackson, died Wednesday at age 89.
The Jackson 5's performance on The Ed Sullivan Show was the beginning of their rise to fame and fortune. Joe Jackson was the man behind the legendary group. The Jackson family patriarch was born in Fountain Hill, Arkansas in 1928. His family eventually settled in Indiana, where he pursued a boxing career. After marrying Catherine in 1949, the couple bought a home in Gary and had 10 children together. Joe gave up boxing and started a blues band. The group broke up after they couldn't get a record deal. He transferred his dream to make it big in music to his kids, who went on to become some of the biggest pop stars in the world. Jackson had a tumultuous relationship with his children. Several of them accused him of physical and emotional abuse. Joe was by Michael's side during the late pop star's child molestation trial, but when Michael died of a drug overdose in 2009, Joe was cut out of his son's will. In a 2013 interview, the patriarch said he didn't regret being hard on his kids.
I'm glad I was tough, because look what I came out with. I came out with some kids that everybody loved all over the world.
Jackson struggled with health issues in recent years, suffering from at least two strokes. Jackson was 89. Danielle Nottingham, CBS News.
Coming up, one straightforward way to beat the heat this weekend.
Just be naked. Why not?
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like
the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt.
Climate's changing. We contribute to it. I've said that 1,000 times.
Democratic National Committee Chair, Tom Perez.
This president has absolutely no moral compass.
Trump cabinet member, Linda McMahon.
First time that I met Donald Trump was at a Rolling Stones concert.
Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Millions of us dealing with skyrocketing temperatures this weekend in Detroit. Reporter Charlie Lighton talked to some folks about some of the unusual ways they're using to beat the heat.
About half the country seeing record high temperatures this weekend.
It's going to be a scorcher.
Yep. So how can people keep cool?
We keep cool because we have a warming center at the senior center.
So seniors keep cool at the warming center?
Warming and cooling center.
Well, that's better. But Zanetta McCaddy has a way to beat the heat.
Stay nude. I mean, you're going to sweat if you have on clothes. They're going to stick to you. You'll be uncomfortable. Just be naked. Why not?
Yeah, why not? I think I'll start now. Charlie Lighton for CBS News, Detroit.
Toys R Us closes shop with the last of its stores closing Friday. Correspondent John Schumo talked about it with CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger.
It thrilled generations of children.
This is the Lego set that I got.
But the shelves at Toys R Us stores across the country are now bare.
It's just sad and heartbreaking.
Charles Lazarus opened his first store in 1948, selling baby furniture in Washington, D.C. A few years later, he turned his attention to toys.
I don't want to grow up, fun toys wrecking.
With catchy jingles and a logo a child might write, Toys R Us grew to revolutionize retail in the decades that followed.
Toys R Us was the largest toy retailer for a good chunk of its 70-year history, and it was iconic in many ways.
But the company eventually fell on hard times. Attempts to alleviate mounting debt failed, and the once dominant brand declared bankruptcy.
A combination of the structure of the company plus the advent of an online shopping universe just made survivability impossible.
The chain announced it was going out of business in March, with some 700 stores shutting down. The final 200 closed their doors for good on Friday, a disappointing end to what was once the world's biggest toy store. John Schumo, CBS News, Secaucus, New Jersey.
The space station gets a new crewmate.
His name is Simon.
I can do a lot. Do you want to know more?
He's a little bigger than a basketball. He weighs 11 pounds and has 14 small fans that will shoot him around the International Space Station. Simon is short for Crew Interactive Mobile Companion, in plain English, the first artificial intelligence robot in space. And he has a face. IBM's Brett Greenstein says that was essential.
You get feedback and interaction, and while you're speaking, you can tell you're being understood.
Greenstein says Simon can understand and respond to human emotions as well as commands. He'll serve as Station Commander Alexander Gerst's right-hand man. I mean, robot. Peter King, CBS News, Orlando.
An inspiring story about one man breaking barriers in business.
On Long Island, John Cronin is building a sock business with his dad.
I don't care who you are.
Absolutely.
There's a sock for you here.
Right.
The 22-year-old with Down syndrome handles all sorts of jobs.
Is this a new design?
A new design.
You drew this?
I drew this one.
Which leaves his father, Mark, proud but not surprised.
It's why you have such a following.
He knew Down syndrome didn't mean limits. Others might assume it would.
He came to me and said, Dad, I want to go into business with you.
So 18 months ago, John's Crazy Socks was born.
Good. All right, I'm getting in my car.
At $2.2 million in revenue so far, they're doing well, with 16 of 35 jobs they created held down by differently abled workers. They're also doing good.
They're excited to be here. They have great skills and a great spirit.
Certain socks are linked to certain charities. Each pair sold generates a donation, $100,000 and counting.
Hey, everyone.
While YouTube and social media have helped spread the word, their most famous customer put them on the map.
Who's that letter from?
That's from George Bush.
The president who signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law.
On World Down Syndrome Day, he wore John's Down Syndrome superhero socks and sent out a tweet of him wearing them and thanking his friend John Cronin.
That was good for business. But when the 41st president wore a pair of John's Crazy Socks to pay tribute to Barbara Bush's literacy campaigns at her funeral, well, that was good for the soul.
It makes me feel good.
While the Cronins see money in warming feet,
can you sing?
Yeah.
They're about to corner the market on warming hearts along the way.
Let's not push Christmas.
Jim Axelrod, CBS News, Huntington, New York.
Finally this weekend, a tribute to an American hero who received the highest military award Tuesday. His story, though, was largely unknown, even to his widow, who accepted his Medal of Honor. Correspondent David Martin visited his hometown.
He loved the Army.
Pauline Wells was 15 years old when she and the rest of Albany, Kentucky, turned out to welcome Garland Merle Connor home from World War II.
Daddy decided he would bring us to the parade, so he hitched the horses to the wagon.
Connor had fought his way across North Africa, Sicily, Italy, France, and into Germany, and been awarded an astounding 4 Silver Stars and 1 Distinguished Service Cross.
Mother said, now there he is. And I said, well, my gosh, that little wharf rat, there's no way he could have done all the things that they said he done.
His commanding officer wrote that Connor was one of the outstanding soldiers of this war, if not the outstanding. Pauline didn't know any of that when she eloped and married him.
Did you see any evidence of what he'd been through?
A lot of times of a night, he would be dreaming, and he'd wake up fighting.
Connor died in 1998. 6 years later, researchers found affidavits by Connor's fellow soldiers describing how he had beaten back waves of attacking Germans. He took off like a bat out of hell, heading straight toward the source of enemy fire. All this time, a terrific hail of small arms and machine gun fire was concentrated on his position, out there all alone, calling in artillery fire on the Germans. Those affidavits finally made it to the White House.
They called me on a Friday and said I'd be getting an important phone call. I thought, what if it's a scam? What if I'm here by myself and it is a scam? And it was from the President of the United States.
Of all the days in your life, where would you rank that day?
I have to say it was one of the happiest days of my life, but really and truly the happiest day was when I married him.
You know, I came down here expecting to hear a war story.
Yes.
But what you're telling me is a love story.
Yes, it is.
In 1945, Connor's commanding officer wrote, "I've never seen a man with as much courage and ability." 73 years later, Pauline accepted her husband's Medal of Honor, making that statement part of American history. David Martin, CBS News, Albany, Kentucky.
That does it for the weekend roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Jake Rosen is the intern. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.